All right. Glad everyone's here today. Thank you all very much. I'm going to give a little bit of, I guess, a warning, if you will. This is dark. This is dark stuff that we're going to be talking about. It's very, very challenging. Another thing that I want you all to be very aware of is some of the ways that I may come across may sound a little bit, I don't know, gruff. Might sound maybe a little bit accusatory. I want everyone in here to know, first and foremost, I absolutely love the church. I love the church. But are there some things that we are doing in our churches that aren't right? Yes. And so basically the way that I want to present this, and if you do end up staying for the next session, beware, you're probably going to hear a little bit of the same at the beginning. Let's consider this a family talk, okay? There's an issue that we have to deal with. We're sitting around the kitchen table now, and we're going to be talking about what's going on. And we're going to come to terms with it. We're going to deal with it a little bit. So, buckle up. Let's get rolling. So I've already let you know we're going to be talking about something that's challenging. But based on how much it's spoken on and talked about in our congregations, it seems like there's an attitude of, hey, this isn't going to happen to us. It doesn't happen here. This isn't our problem. Or it's taboo. It's impolite to talk about something that is so dark. This might be something that you've experienced with your congregation. But that's part of the reason, since we don't talk about it, and since we don't teach about it, that's part of the reason why we have such a problem today. I'm going to take a poll real quick. In here, in the last 12 months, how many of y'all have heard a sermon on Sunday morning about sexual abuse? Look around. There's no hands. How many in the last 12 months on a Sunday morning in your congregation have heard a sermon on domestic abuse? I'll let y'all know that there are no hands up in the room. We're not talking about this. Now let me ask you this. How many of y'all, through watching the news in a 7-day period, and you don't have to watch all three newscasts morning, noon, and night, just one newscast throughout a 7-day period. Think about it. Is it possible to watch the news without seeing some news story about someone being arrested under investigation for abuse? Raise your hands if you've seen one of those news stories. Look around. We have a challenge. But with these problems come opportunities for us to serve. So I'm going to give you a little bit of my story. Prior to feeling the need to begin spreading the news about this challenge, I can tell you that of thousands of sermons that I heard in my life. So I was born, matter of fact, Mom was telling me they brought me home to a house here in Norman. So I was born here in Norman, was raised in a Christian family, attended Harding University, okay? Graduated Harding University, then went on and continued attending. I had no breaks, have attended to this day. To date, outside of the messages that I bring or messages that other advocate friends that I know of in the brotherhood, I have heard 2 sermons on abuse, and I'll tell you they didn't happen on Sunday morning. Many across the country that I've spoken to, whenever I go and I do my Watchman seminars, whenever we converse with each other, they've experienced a very, very similar ratio. Thousands of sermons, 1, maybe 2, where abuse might even be brushed against. Many have shared their story either after a seminar, after a blog post that I'll write, or they'll reach out to me after they read my book, What Kind of Watchman Are You? Which Wayne introduced in the introduction. So today we're going to be talking about four things. There's four things that I want y'all to remember today. Four. This is a topic for Christians and for the church. Abuse should be taught about in the home with support of the church. We must create a climate of abuse prevention in order to gain a culture of abuse prevention. And abuse is like the flu. So as we're talking about this today, we're going to be talking about abuse prevention in a couple of different ways. We're going to be talking about it at a very high level, very strategic, and we're also going to be talking about it at a very low level. Hey, I can go and I can teach my kids about this today, and they're going to be better protected. So as we roll into this, let's start talking about the strategic. So when we're talking about it at a very high level, I want to ask the question, why do we have such the disconnect? So earlier, we had that poll. We had everyone's hands up that had heard a news story. But whenever I asked about in the last 12 months, when this had been talked about in your congregation, there were no hands that were up. That's a disconnect. That is a disconnect between our churches and what we're dealing with out in the world. So then the next question, and perhaps this is another shameless plug, but where are the good watchmen? It's the reason why I wrote the book. My ministry is named the Ezekiel 33 Project for a reason. So in Ezekiel 33 verses 2 through 6, we have two watchmen that are described. One is the bad watchman. This is a guy that's up on the wall and he sees the dust cloud off in the distance with the enemy coming, and he doesn't sound the alarm. And what happens to the people of the city? They're harmed. Why are they harmed? Because the watchman didn't sound the alarm. Who's at fault? The watchman that didn't sound the alarm. Then we've got a tale of a good watchman. The good watchman's up on top of the wall. He sees the dust cloud coming with the enemy approaching. He sounds the alarm. And most everyone in the city does what it is that they're supposed to do. But there might be some that don't. Those that don't, if they're harmed, whose fault is it? It's their fault because they didn't listen to the watchman and do what it was they were supposed to do. But the watchman did what he was supposed to do, and he sounded the alarm. This comes about because how many times do we hear of an abuser that after their arrest, we find out that it wasn't just one victim, it was many. I'll tell you the average for the number of victims that an abuser will have is between 50 and 150, depending on the preferences of the abuser. So now, as we've asked that question, how is it that abuse is so prevalent in our society, yet our congregations are so silent on the subject? So churches strive for strong marriages. Wayne and Tammy do an awesome job. They do an incredible job of strengthening and building marriages. There's also a strong desire within the church to help parents out in parenting. Some of the material that Steve Miner has about helping families grow their children into young Christian leaders is absolutely amazing. So we have marriage seminars, we have parenting seminars, but we're painfully silent on this topic. So on topics of abuse, we have a whole bunch of silence. But how is abuse going to end up impacting a marriage, one might ask? Well, very often, if your child is going to be abused, you know and love the individual that is going to abuse your child. Stop looking for the creepy dude next to the 7-Eleven in a trench coat. He doesn't exist. It's going to be someone that you know and that you love. How does that impact a marriage? Normally, how it'll end up working is you'll have one spouse who is closer to, maybe it's a family member, so maybe they come from their family, or maybe it's a close friend, and the close friend is really close with another one of the spouses. So when abuse ends up happening, the abusers are very, very clever. With the relationship that they have, they exploit that to get one parent to minimize what it was that happened to their child while the other one is seeking justice. And when that happens, you have conflict in the marriage. The probability of divorce and with a couple that has experienced abuse within the home is greatly more than a couple who has not experienced that. A few other items regarding it. Abuse is going to impact the raising of a child. It's going to impact the child, how they view life going forward. And it's also going to impact the parents' relationships with others as they go forward as well. So the local church is very often where many are going to go to for counsel in times of turmoil. Excuse me. And it's for that fact that we have so many ministry opportunities, because people will come to the church whenever they're experiencing these challenges. However, very often the local church is not prepared. They're not prepared for an accusation of abuse. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't have a set of resources that are ready to go. And sometimes in that situation, they'll then try to handle it in-house, which very often is dangerous. They have little understanding of the breadth of the issue, and very often they offer extremely poor or sometimes illegal advice. Illegal advice in sweeping it under the rug as opposed to reporting it to authorities. I don't remember the exact law. I know in Texas, I believe it's Texas chapter 251, the family code, elders, ministers, parents, you're obligated by law to go and report. Teachers, yes, absolutely, absolutely. In Oklahoma, I know they have a similar law. I don't remember the number, and I might have got a digit wrong on that Texas one, but it's there. So we need to be, one thing that I will add to this, and this is especially important for those congregations that have multi-generational families in attendance, okay? So you have grandparents, you have adult children, you have grandchildren. If adult children are going to the church for advice on a family issue in that situation, it isn't an automatic, but let that be a red flag. Because when family's close by, more often than not, when there's family challenges, the family will talk it out amongst themselves. But if you have an intergenerational situation where you know that everyone lives close, but the adult children go to the church for advice, the adult children don't think they're getting the best advice from mom and dad. And they may very well be being manipulated at that point in time. So it's evident that we have an information gap that's caused by a lack of teaching and an unbelief that the problem may exist. The information gap is harming our families and our congregations. The statistics are consistent across the board. This is something that I mentioned yesterday in my little preview about Ezekiel 33. 20% across the board, no matter which way it is that politicians like to divide us, that's how it goes. And it's because of these statistics that we must face this reality. So now let's move on to abuse prevention. Prevention in the home. So congregations need to support families in efforts of teaching their children about abuse prevention, because congregations can't prevent abuse without families actively teaching their children about abuse. But with educated parents and congregational support, then we add layers. So what do I mean by layers? It's relatively safe to say that most kids attend public school, or they'll attend a private school. But in those school situations, these children are at least attending one place where people have been trained in how to deal with abuse. But if mom and dad haven't trained themselves, and the church isn't trained, then basically those children, the children are probably safer in public school than what they are in their own home or in their congregation, because the people aren't trained. However, if families are trained and congregations are trained, then we've added two additional layers of support for these families. Okay, so I can say that the details are all different, but we're going to talk about some of the following things that are high-level things that are consistent across the board in cases of abuse. Lack of education. Lack of education across the board. The children don't know what to look out for. The parents don't know what to look out for. Congregations don't know what to look out for. And church leadership and employees, and when I say employees, I'm talking paid staff, don't know what to look for. Very often there's an underestimation of the risk. An underestimation of the risk by the parents, by those that know the abuser, or by the church. I'll give you one example that I'm aware of, that I know of. One example that I know of in someone underestimating the risk was a young man who was known to have a problem. The young man was known to have a problem, and the family of this individual chose not to speak up. It was only after the third time that he had been caught that the family finally recognized that there was an issue. But even after he was caught a third time, he's such a good kid. He's had such a hard time. We couldn't possibly turn him into the authorities, because then he'd just end up turning into a monster in the justice system. That's how people rationalize that. They don't recognize the risk. There's a lack of familiarity with the molester's toolbox. Every story is different on the specifics, but there is a consistency across every story of abuse. And this goes all the way back to 2 Samuel 13 and the story about David's oldest son, Amnon, and one of David's daughters, Tamar. Every story utilizes the molester's toolbox. The molester's toolbox is something that I go in detail in my seminars. It's something that I go in detail in my book. I don't have time to go into detail with it today, but I'll tell you what the three of them are. The three are this: deception, empathy, and apathy. All cases of abuse utilize deception, empathy, and apathy. It's like a three-legged stool. One leg, maybe two legs, okay, you've got a little bit of balance and stability. If you get all three together, there is definitely danger there. So now let's look at the tactical. We've thought about it conceptually at very high level. Some of the things are in play. Now let's look at the tactical. Conversations about abuse need to begin in the home early and often. They need to be age appropriate. We don't need to terrify our children, but we can start having conversations about good touch and bad touch. It can be as simple as, what does a swimsuit cover? No one should be touching you where a swimsuit covers. It can be as simple as that. There's also no forced affection. That's another thing that we can teach our kids. That's where we can begin to teach our kids that they have the right to say no regarding someone touching their body. No forced affection. Let me give you an example of it, okay? So family goes and hits the road and goes to grandma and grandpa's house for Thanksgiving. We've all seen this. There's kind of the reception line. There's the knock at the door, and the door swings open, and grandma and grandpa are real excited to see the family, and everyone's hugging and smiling, and everything's great. Grandma and grandpa squat down, and maybe, let's say in this fictitious family, there's three kids, and there's that one kid. There's the one kid that doesn't want to hug grandma and grandpa. So the parents stay somewhat embarrassed at the door because little Joey doesn't want to hug grandma and grandpa. So what do the parents do? Joey, hug your grandma and your grandpa. Or do we say, hey, you know what? He really doesn't want to give affection right now. That's okay. That's the right approach. Because they should have the right to say no to whoever, whenever, as opposed to us forcing them to do something they don't want to do with their body. There's nothing sexual about that whatsoever. It is clearly just giving them the right to say no. Because if we don't give them the right to say no with grandparents, with someone who is manipulating them, well, they didn't have the right to say no to grandma and grandpa, someone that's manipulating them, they have the mental thought that they don't have the right to say no. We also need to educate our children not on the what abuse someone touching where a swimsuit might cover, et cetera, et cetera. We also need to educate on the how. How does this happen? Abusers very rarely are just going to reach out and grab. It's going to be a brush. Maybe at a regular interval, but it's going to be a brush. It's going to be a casual touch. It's not going to be a touch with intention. See, one thing about this is there's a term out there called grooming with sexual abuse. I'm beginning to change the way that I think about this word, and it's not really grooming, it's testing. So if they brush up against somebody, does that somebody say no? Does that child feel empowered to say no? And if they do, then they're going to move on to someone else. If they don't, then maybe things escalate. Accidental porn left visible. Accidental porn left visible. That is another test that an abuser very often will use in order to see if the secret stays just between the abuser and the child. But since it's just accidental porn left visible, if the child goes and tells mom and dad, and mom and dad go back to the abuser and say, hey, Joey said that this, he saw this at your house. Since nothing's really happened yet, then very often the very crafty abuser will come up with some narrative as to why that was visible, or that it's the child's vivid imagination, and very often it's dismissed, when in fact, that was a test run. That was a test run to see if the child was going to talk to mom and dad about what they saw in the abuser's car, at the abuser's house, in the abuser's office. Be a no-secret family. Be a no-secret family. So what does that mean? We need to make it absolutely clear to our children that we have no secrets in our family. So if somebody is doing something with your child and they say, we can't ever talk about this to anyone, ever, that should set off alarm bells in the child's head, because, hey, I come from a no secret family. Surprises? Yes. Surprises are secrets that have an expiration date. Surprise birthday party. Hey, Joey, 3 weeks from now, we're going to surprise Uncle Bob. We can't say anything about it right now, but what's going to happen is we're all going to gather at so-and-so's house, and when Uncle Bob shows up, we're going to jump out, we're going to say surprise, and it's a happy occasion. Surprises have a happy occasion to them. Secrets very often are keeping something dark inside. Stranger danger is dangerous. I've already mentioned that 90% of abusers know the child. You're likely to know and love the individual. Children must be able to speak up against anyone, and I do mean anyone, and be believed rather than doubted. One thing I want to talk about, One thing that I want to go into a little bit deep here, and this is more on the church side. So this is some of the stuff that where I was saying up front that I might sound a little bit gruff, like I'm not very tolerant of, and quite frankly, I'm not tolerant of it. But this is a family discussion, okay? We do a very good job. So we've stated the stats, right? 90% are known to us. We do a very good job of putting our hands down, letting our guard down when someone is known to us. Because of that fact, predators exploit that. So up here I've got the no chaperoning of convicted offenders at your congregation. So I want to talk about this regarding a case that I'm aware of that happened in Arkansas. All right, so this happened in Arkansas. Essentially what a chaperoning situation is this. So a congregation wants to have a ministry. They want to have a ministry where they reach out to those who are spurned by society. Well, we can't really think of anyone who's spurned by society more than a convicted sex offender of children, right? So very often what ends up happening is these ministries start out with a couple of individuals in a congregation, normally the minister is involved as well, and a contract is drawn up. And this contract is something where basically, it's drafted out where an offender can go within the church building. It's drafted out that the offender will be surrounded by two other volunteers that know the status of this individual. It's normally drawn out in the contract that if this individual has to go to the bathroom during service, one of his buddies have to go with him to make sure that he has eyes on him at all times. And offenders will sign this gladly, and they'll attend your congregations. They will gladly attend your congregations under these chaperoning agreements. But there's unintended consequences with these agreements. This particular case in Arkansas, there was a congregation that had a chaperoning agreement. The offender was a regular attender. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. He had no problem with obeying all the rules of the agreement. There was no issue whatsoever. So what was the problem? The church was unable to account for what he would do outside of the congregation, outside of regular church attendance. And because the agreement stated that he could attend the regular assembly that happened, he would sit there in between the two people that would be minding him, and he would recognize a little girl that would come in. She was always wearing something softball. Always something softball. One Wednesday night, she cruises in with a softball jersey on. It's got the name, her name on the back of it. With those two pieces of information, this offender knew that this little girl loved softball and knew her name. So what did the offender do? He didn't do anything at church. He did absolutely nothing within the church. He did everything according to the agreement that the church had done, thinking that they were protecting the congregation. He started going to the ball fields until he found the particular ball field that this little girl played at. Now, remember, there's only a handful of people in this congregation that knew, only a handful that knew that there was a chaperoning program where registered offenders would be in attendance at the regular services. So the family sees the guy that's always sitting over in the right-hand middle back section. Hey, we go to church with you. Oh, yeah, yeah, I wanted to come and I wanted to see your daughter play. I knew that she was really interested in softball. Oh, well, that's great. So they strike up a conversation. Nothing about his status came up, obviously. So as the offender is sitting there, he observes that there is also a little brother decked out in a T-ball uniform and that mom is tending to an infant. As the game is winding down, hey, I need to go warm him up, get him ready for his game. And oh, by the way, the infant's getting a little bit fussy. Mom needs to take him to the car to attend to him. Will you watch her? What does he say? Yes! Yes, I will gladly watch your little girl. I'm not going to finish the rest of the story. Use your imagination. You know. You know. No chaperoning of offenders at your congregation, please. All right. So now we're going to talk about abuse prevention in a situation of we need to create a culture of abuse prevention within our congregations. This is where I'm going to get a little bit organizational theory on y'all, but that's a risk of what Wayne gets for putting someone in business up here rather than in full-time ministry. So here we go. All right. So climate versus culture. What's the difference? Well, so you can change climate in an instant, but culture takes a very long time to change. And I'll give you an example. So I manage a group of programmers at work, okay? So if I come into the office, here, I'm gonna get over here. If I come into the office, morning, I'm going and getting coffee. What does my team want to do with me that day? They want to leave me alone. I have created an organizational climate of let's stay away from boss today. Okay? Now, if we reset that. Hey, Julian, how you doing this morning? Michelle, what's going on? How's that report going? Hey, I'm gonna go grab a cup of coffee. You need anything? Okay. What is my organizational climate? I did that. I changed my climate just like that because of how I acted. Now, if over 365 days, my team knows that I'm gonna come in, I'm gonna check on everyone, I'm concerned about them, maybe I offer to go get them something, eventually, my organization develops a culture of they know that I care about them. They know that I will go and get them something. They will know that I will help out. Or if I'm the first act, I'm going to have a turnover problem within my organization. Period. Okay? Now, let's think about this in terms of abuse prevention. So whenever as a congregation, if there's only one lesson on abuse a year, which at the beginning of this, no one had experienced, how in the world are we going to create a culture of abuse prevention if we don't even talk about it once a year? If we talk about it once a year, what we do is we create a climate of abuse prevention for about 3 weeks. And then at the end of those 3 weeks, we're on to the next shiny red ball. There needs to be a steady conversation to create a culture of abuse prevention. So after a very long exposure to a climate to where it's okay for us to talk about abuse prevention, where it's okay to have lessons on abuse prevention, then we can gain that. I got ahead of myself. Awesome. Okay. So, what's the congregational culture where you're at? What's the culture like? I have a suspicion based on the show of hands, but I'm going to ask some questions. How often is this preached on? Is this a discussion point in the premarital counseling that is provided by the ministers at your congregation to perhaps prepare a young couple for what could potentially happen to their children? How often is it talked about? How are your congregation's policies on abuse distributed to those within the congregation? And even further, whenever we have new families that join the congregation, how are those policies distributed to those new families? And here's a very interesting question. Are the policies of your congregation, do they go beyond just the stereotypical boilerplate, insurance company mandated, do you run a background check on everyone that would deal with kids? So I'll tell you something, little secret about my family. There are two predators in my family. Two. One of them, you can look him up on the state of Texas website. You'll see his mug. All right? There's another that is not on the offenders list. Those are the ones that you need to worry about. You see, DAs are funny things. They're people. Sometimes offenders, even though caught red-handed, the DA, either because of their workload, because of the perceived level of offense or whatever, will make the decision not to prosecute. So we need to be wary not only of those who are on a list, but even more concerned about those who are not on a list. So families, it's your job to educate children on abuse, and churches, it's your job to assist those families in teaching on this topic. And as we're winding down now.
Can I make a comment about what you said before? Those under the age of majority in the state of Texas, oftentimes the defense attorney will expunge that conviction.
Yes, sir.
And that will not even be publicized or made known on any website that means sexual predator.
Correct.
Yes.
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 Thank you. Thank you. Yes. And you're absolutely correct. And then to go along with what Chris has mentioned, these predators, they might want to stop, but they can't. So even if it's expunged, you still have them in your midst. So now as we're winding down, my final point that I want to bring up to y'all, and this is this was very, very hard as I was making this presentation, but the bottom line is this. I can tell y'all about abuse prevention, and the bottom line, predators are practiced liars, and they're good at it. And as a result, abuse is like the flu. What do I mean by that? So when we're thinking about the flu, we can wash our hands, we can get our flu shot, we can take our vitamins, we can exercise, we can do everything right, and we can still get the flu. And abuse is the exact same way. You can do everything right, and things happen. But with educated parents and strong support from an educated family and an educated congregation, those who experience abuse can have a far, far better outcome. So to summarize everything, if this is a topic for Christians and for the church, abuse is something that is to be taught about in the home with support of the church. We must create a climate of abuse prevention in order to gain a culture of abuse prevention, and abuse is like the flu. I thank y'all for y'all's time. Thank you. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. And that's actually one of the things that I do talk about in my Watchman seminars. And it's been a while since I've looked at this material, but the number one reason why a church will be sued, I believe it was since 2013. Don't completely quote me on that. It's 2013, 2014, sometime in around there. The number one reason why a congregation will be sued is the sexual abuse of a child across all denominations and the church itself. Yes, sir.
You were talking about the no chaperoning.
Yes.
Section. And you might talk about it in this next class, I don't know, but so what's the answer to that? Do we tell the whole congregation about this person? Because I know there's always the fear of, well, we forgive them, so we push that to the side, but
right.
Where do we draw the line and say, no, we do forgive them, but we have to do something?
Okay. Yes, and that's part of the reason why I gave the preface that I did at the beginning as well. And I'll tell you where I stand, and you can tell me that I'm dreaming, and that's fine. But I think it would be safe to say that almost everyone in here has experienced a church program dealing with a retirement facility or a convalescent home where a group of people go and they will have a worship service with those who are unable to attend. So it is Steve Black's opinion that in a situation where you have an offender that wants to come and to worship, at that point in time, then you have a ministry where perhaps it's on Sunday afternoon in some room with a group, if it's a male offender, with a group of men that will go and that will minister and have a worship time with that individual. That one keeps any child away from it. And two, the congregation, yes, does need to know that on Sunday afternoons, this happens in this room. Everyone needs to know. That kind of goes to the whole no secret family. Church, no secret family. That is a best practice that has been identified in the advocacy world. Very often, what will be discovered in a situation like that is whenever those boundaries are put in place, is when you will find if the individual is truly repentant or not. Because very often, whenever it's, okay, well, we're gonna have a worship in classroom 33, where it's gonna be a group of men and we're gonna sing, we're gonna offer communion, we're gonna pray, and we're gonna study the Bible with you. Very often, if they're unrepentant and they're trying to game the system, they will become extremely angry because you're taking away what they want, which is the presence of children.